I want to welcome everyone to our Keeping on Track open line, the transaction of a lifetime, strategies for planning your sale or transfer. My name is Dana Barocca. I'm the CEO of Lighthouse Consulting Services and will be hosting our program today. We have a few housekeeping items and we'll jump right into our topic. For those of you joining us for the first time at Lighthouse, everything we do goes back to our mission statement to help keep organizations off the rocks of potential self-destruction. We do this through our in-depth work style assessments for raising the hiring bar and to assist companies with a variety of services, including interpersonal coaching, executive onboarding for success, leadership training for the 21st century, exploring global options for expanding your business, sales and customer service training, and operational productivity improvement. Each of our programs helps to avoid getting stuck in shallow waters so our clients have smooth sailing. Andy's a sailor, so he understands that analogy. We also offer a number of workshop topics to associations and trade organizations. If you'd like more information, please email me as indicated on your screen. Our Keeping a Track open line series is a response to a number of calls we've been getting from many of our clients, both domestically and globally, to address the various business issues that most organizations are facing today. Our goal is to make this an interactive program, so on your screen, you'll see an area you can send questions or ideas during our discussion. We'll attempt to respond to as many as possible, so please join us with your thoughts and insights you have along the way. At the conclusion of the program, we'll open up the line so you can talk directly with our guests. You'll also want to have some paper and a pen handy to take notes, since we'll be sharing many ideas that you'll want to consider and implement with your team and trusted advisors. You can also print out the slides for today. You'll see a print icon in the lower right-hand corner of the slide area. Our four special guests with us today are very unique and have quite a bit of experience and talent under their belt. We're going to start with Andy, and you can see everybody's picture and contact information on the lower part of the screen there. Andy Horowitz will guide us through and navigate this topic today. He is a VP with Morgan Stanley. Andy is a former third-generation family business owner who has successfully built and sold two separate family-owned businesses, both in the service and manufacturing sectors, doing business with such companies as Walmart, ProBass Shops, Yamaha, Kawasaki, and Nissan Motor Corporation. Andy's practice at Morgan Stanley focuses in the area of succession and transition planning for family businesses. He is a nationally recognized speaker on this topic and has spoken at many business owner conferences, including McDonald's, Subway, Choice Hotels, Genworth Financial, as well as continued educational forums for CPAs, attorneys, insurance agents, and wealth managers. We have Rick Andrade, who is a managing director at Janus Associates in Pasadena, California. His background encompasses over two decades of CEO and CFO advisory, providing mid-market business owners with a concrete roadmap solutions to their strategic challenges. He has provided consulting services to Fortune 500 companies, including Amgen, Mellon Bank, Sky Chef, and Warner Brothers, to design and implement state-of-the-art finance and performance management strategies and systems. We have Ron Friedman, CPA, with us, who is with Assurance Services with Markham LLP. He is a partner in charge of the Southern California region. As a member of the firm's National Retail Consumer Products Industry Group, he provides consulting services for closely held and emerging businesses in the apparel, manufacturing, distribution, and retail industries. His services include forecasting and budgeting, profit enhancement, succession planning, exit strategies, preparation for sale of a business, assistance in procuring financing and workout, and reorganization consulting. Mr. Friedman's expertise also includes assistance in the negotiations for the purchase or sale of a business. We have Lewis Stanton. Is the managing partner of Stanton Associates, LLC. He is experienced in working with founders and subsequent generation owners and their team to unlock company's potential. Before founding Stanton Associates in 2004, Stanton was several times CEO, including most recently the CEO of eTeam, a software company which had experienced years of losses with minimal growth prior to his joining, and then it skyrocketed. Stanton was the COO of a public technology company. In this capacity, he grew the company's high-margin revenues by 300% in less than 3 years, and also took the company from $10 million in annual losses to tremendous profitability. He also has participated in, as a turnaround CEO for other companies in several different industries. I feel privileged to have our guests with us today and to share ideas that will help each of us in preparing for the future and for dealing with today's business issues. Also, registration for our next program will begin at the end of today's program. The topic will be how stress eats your profits. I want to welcome each of you. Andy?
Yes, sir.
Take it away.
Thank you so much, Dan. I really appreciate you putting on such a great program, and welcome everybody to our talk today. I appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedules. You know, it's really interesting. All the time people are asking me, you know, Andy, building and selling businesses and being a business owner that does financial planning today, you know, what is it that makes this so exciting for you? Why do you enjoy it? And I think back to when I was 13 years old scraping barnacles on the bottoms of boats and building that into a manufacturing business, and the thrill and the excitement of building a business. And I realize that there's many businesses all over the world that have that same excitement, but they don't go without challenges. So today what we're going to do is we're going to talk about some of those pitfalls and things and ways that you can work around those. And as a result of that, one of the reasons why I'm also excited about it is I think about the way we can help so many people. You know, by having a great team and great members on that team, it's so vital that we look at these things. And it reminds me of one of the very first clients I actually ever met. And I go back and I think of meeting this founder of this family business, and the family owner business started in the 1950s, and they were in the landscape business. And what they actually did was they were going landscaping and putting in pipe and putting in, you know, grass and all these other things, and they would see all these kids coming back and all these kids growing up because it was the 50s and 60s and, you know, all the baby boomers were coming back, and all of a sudden they said, you know what, maybe we should do something for kids. So what they actually did is they took the pipe that they were doing landscaping with, and they created swing sets. And how fun of a business would that be, creating swing sets that kids can play on, families can be around. And this swing set business, they actually started selling them locally, and eventually they met with the buyer of a place called Sears Roebuck & Company. Well, Sears Roebuck & Company turned around, and they started buying the swing sets, and the factory started to grow, and they started hiring more employees, and they started, you know, they started manufacturing, getting steel and cutting it and growing it. Well, the business got very large, and it got to the point that one day they were in all Sears stores all over the United States. Well, in the 1950s and 1960s, you may have heard the story about Sears Roebuck, how they'll put you out of business if they're a big customer of yours. And in the financial world, they call that concentration of customers. Well, you know the story from here. The business turned around. It grew very rapidly. That was their only customer. They didn't diversify. And all of a sudden, the buyer for Sears Roebuck & Company decided to have a different person as their supplier. Well, next thing you know, this company has all this inventory, and they have no other customers, and they're, you know, having a problem getting rid of their inventory, and they go out of business. Well, unfortunately, that's the story of a lot of family-owned businesses, and over time, we realize that there's many things that we can do. This particular story is so interesting to me because this is the story of my grandfather's swing set business. And that's maybe one of the reasons why, as I grew my businesses, many of the pitfalls that I realized there, I realized if I could get around these areas, maybe I could do better. So I want to go to the next screen, if we can, Dan, and let's talk about the big picture. And in the big picture, as we talk about, when we talk about financial planning, there are many different aspects when you own a business. Many times you have your business where you're trying to, you know, look at your business and then do your personal life around the business, and other people are doing personal stuff around the business. Well, the reality is there's lots of different areas that you can focus on, right? The business need, the personal need, cash management, capital needs for the business, retirement plans, risk, you know, what are you going to do personal-wise in terms of your wealth plans? And then, of course, you have all your documents, both personally, tax returns, copies of insurance policies, buy-sell agreements, you know, 401k, all this different stuff. Well, today we're not going to talk about all these different areas. We're going to focus today in an area of succession and exit planning. And what I find is exit and succession planning is such an important point because many people aren't focused on it. If you go to the next screen, Dana, we'll talk about succession planning and the main important parts of succession planning. You see, when I think about succession planning, one of the things that's really important is that there's really a process that you have to go through. It's just like when you write a business plan for a business and you want to think of all the different contingencies, you want to do the same thing when you're doing a business and you want to transition it, whether it's to a key employee, to a family member, whether it's to a third party or to a strategic buyer, whether it be, you know, levering up your balance sheet to generate cash. The reality is there's lots of things, and if you do it right, you're going to go back 2 or maybe 3 years prior to that sale date is when all this begins. And we're going to talk about these various stages. Specifically at the beginning, we talk about pre-planning, and then we're going to talk about short-term planning. And in the short-term planning, those are going to be focused on that time frame of just a 2-year period. Then we're going to talk about negotiations and what type of negotiations we have to deal with, and then strategies and what you're going to do next after this is completed. If you can go to the next slide, we're going to talk a little bit about that, because in here, this is where we start talking about many of those areas that are focused in the things that you want to do. So if we look at the areas of pre-planning, many of these things include things like your family and your business, and you just want to make sure that you're considering these things. If you go to the next page, it says our agenda on the top, right? Dana? Hello, Dana?
Let me go back. There we go.
So okay. It says our agenda, correct?
Yes.
Go to the next slide.
Forward?
Yes.
Next one?
Yes. My slide didn't change.
Oh. We're on the assembling your advisory team.
Okay. For some reason, mine's not working, but I'll follow along with you. Anyways, so as we start talking about pre-planning, it's really important that we want to focus on all these things. You know, what do I want to do for my family? What do I have to do worrying about tax and valuation impacts? What do I want to do to make sure that the business, you know, and what is it really worth? And at the end of the day, what you'll find is you've got to make sure you've got a good team that's around you, because not one person has all the answers. You know, you might have an accountant, for example, that's been with you for 20 years, but he may not be an exact expert in valuation. You may have an investment banker that's been calling you about your business all this time who wants to help you sell your business, but maybe you want to sell to a key employee or a family member, but you've got to have an investment banker so you know what a reasonable price is. You've got to make sure you have an attorney, and there's different types of attorneys. So putting this team together is so important, because if you don't have the right people on your team, you can cause yourself a problem. And that's why I like to sort of think about these things and why a team is so important. So why don't we go to the next page, the next slide, and I believe that's where it says what else does mind just
planning
involve. Correct, yes. So if a couple of things you want to be focused on, you want to make sure that as you're thinking about where the business is headed and what you're doing, you have to think about what are my goals. In other words, you know, like Jim Rollins says, make sure you have the right butts on the seat. It's the same thing when planning your business. Where do I want to be 3 years, 5 years from now? Do I want to live in the same place? Do I want to move? What are the things I want to be thinking about, and where do I want to go? You know, what do my kids want? What do my family members want? What type of strategies? Do I want to have a complex life of multiple trusts and things like that when I retire? Or do I want to pay the taxes and move on with my life? Do I want to make sure that the business is set up? And at the end of the day, what I'll find is you want to make sure you have the right value. You know, if you have the right value in that business, that can have a huge impact on the value of your business. And in my experience, what I find is it's important to make sure that you have the right value. So maybe we can talk, Rick, a little bit about how do we assess the value of that business, being that it impacts your estate planning, it impacts, you know, your buy-sell agreements, it impacts, you know, all these different elements, and also how much money we're going to have for retirement. Maybe you can talk a little bit about valuations and how you as an investment banker, how you deal with that and how you come up with those values.
Sure, and thanks to everyone for joining us today. Appreciate that. Like Dana said at the beginning, I work at Janus. Janus has been around for 15 years. Carter Freeman is our chairman. We have had dozens and dozens of these types of situations come our way. Over the last 10 years, we've been able to close about 8.5 out of every 10 of these deals. It's very high compared to the industry. But the number one question we get is, Rick, what's it worth? What is my business worth? And they say to me, you know, I've been running my business for 30 years on my gut. Why can't I sell it that way? Well, you can. You certainly can. And if you do that, we compare it to selling almost any other asset, your car, your house, before you paint it and clean it. You'll get a buyer, but you probably will leave a lot of money on the table if you hadn't prepared in advance to fix it up a little bit. And one of the components of doing that is coming up with either a market assessment or evaluation to get a starting point. And the way we look at that as a piece of the puzzle is there are a number of other deals that have been done across the United States and the world that are probably similar to your company in size, in scope, in market segment, and those private companies that are willing to let us see that information is collected by companies like S&P Cap IQ or PitchBook Data if you're a private equity deal. And we look at those multiples. The multiples are essentially a number between, say, 1 and 12 that is multiplied times a profit figure called EBITDA. And most of us probably know what EBITDA is, the earnings before interest, tax, and depreciation. And the idea is to come up with what might be the best and most EBITDA multiple to determine what we would expect the business to sell for in the market. Now, once you come up with a number, you make the adjustments to EBITDA, meaning if there's a lot of expenses that are run through the P&L because the owner's life is run through the P&L, we back those out. That generally increases the profit or EBITDA, and then we add this or multiply this multiple times that figure, and we come up with a rough valuation. So, for instance, if your company has a $1 million EBITDA figure in a growth market, it's got good metrics behind it, and we can talk about what those metrics are, then we might put a higher multiple of, say, 7 or 8 times that, and the business might be then worth roughly $7 to $8 million. But valuation and price are not the same. And I think that's a key fundamental thing to understand, that just because someone says this is going at a 7 or 8 multiple of EBITDA, it doesn't mean that's going to be the price that you're going to pay. And I think Lewis talked a little bit about that having the wrong company in the right industry is exactly what you don't want to do. And one of the things we like to do to avoid that is we reverse engineer the due diligence checklist. And if you don't know what that is, that's when a buyer comes in and says, here's a list of things I'd like to see that I'd like to drill down deeper on. Your performance history and a whole host of other issues. If you have IP, if you have patents, they want to prove that all of these things baked in are really what you think and what they say they are. And once we do that, then we have an opportunity to reverse engineer this due diligence checklist. So if we've had tax problems in the past, or if we have cash management problems, we have management itself, we have other things, we know that the buyers are going to come looking for them. And so we write them down, we work with the owners, and this is some cases 2 or 3 years in advance. Andy talked about customer concentration. I've had a customer in the food business, Santa Barbara Olive Company, years ago, that had a 30% concentration with Sam's Club. And so when my buyers came from both Spain and Italy and the East Coast of the United States, all looking to buy this company, they found that this high level of customer concentration was a bit over the top. So the idea would be if you lose that customer, then you may lose 30% of your sales. So it's one of the things we try to mitigate way up front. When we do that, we're able to avoid what we call the discount money left on the table, meaning if you don't do these things, we can calculate an estimate of between 25 and 30% of the money that your business could be worth could be left on the table if you don't reverse engineer this due diligence checklist. But if you do that, then you might be a lucky member of our 8.5%, 8.5 out of 10 deals that do close. So the idea here is really to work with a team of people in advance so that when you do reverse engineer this due diligence checklist and you find problems, that everybody in the team can understand what to do about it before you actually go to market. So while valuation is an important piece of the price, the idea is once they dig deeper, we don't want to find that there are problems that we could have fixed in advance. So the one thing that I think I like to remind everyone is, Andy had mentioned it, is that the most important thing is to determine your ideal destination and the end result, and then reverse engineer the path backwards using the team that we're going to talk about here, and you'll come up with probably a good way to value your company. That makes
Thank
sense.
You so much, Rick.
A question just came in. how far do you do the planning? How far in advance?
Well, that's a good question. Actually, the planning can start as early as, you know, when you're actually first starting your business. If you plan with an exit in mind and you're always ready, then you're always going to be ready. So there's no such thing as too early. But at a minimum, though, I think you want to be planning at least 2 to 4 years, 2 to 3, 4 years in advance. The longer in advance you are, the more prepared you're going to be for that sale.
Thank you, Andy. Appreciate that. And also, I want to encourage people, if you have any questions or thoughts, throw them onto the chat box, and we'll open up the line at the end of the program so we can talk directly to everybody.
Great. So why don't we go, we're just finishing with that one, obviously making the curb appeal look good, make sure your estate plans are updated. You know, make sure, for example, on the estate planning side, that if you've got assets in your business and you've got a value of this thing, it's a $6, 7, 8 million, or maybe it's $20, 30, or $50 million, you might find that a lot of these assets are more money than you're ever going to need. That future growth of those assets, you don't want them growing in your taxable estate. So you want to make sure your estate plans and your gifting are done in advance before you ever sell this business, because you can come up with a value for tax purposes that might be less than the value that Rick was just talking about. You have a thing called lowest defensible value, which is the rate that the IRS says, the way they do their formulas on the valuation. They may take a market approach like what he's talking about, or they'll take a capitalization of earnings, discounted cash flow. There's a variety of different ways that you value a business, and when you do your valuation for tax purposes and you're going to do gifting, that's why it's so important that you do your financial independence to determine how much money you're going to need for retirement. And if there's any excess money, you want to get that value lower so that way you can transfer it out of your estate to reduce estate taxes. And that's why, of course, you want to make sure your financial plan and estate plans are updated. Dana, why don't you go to the next slide, please? Great. So, you know, as we start looking at short-term planning and we're starting to look at these things, you know, I think it's really important that we understand, you know, what are the things that we can do within this business. We were talking before with Rick about how, you know, you can add back expenses, and we were talking about how you can look at a market approach. But if you dig deeper into the business and you start looking more closely at the operations of the business, I know, Lewis, you've been doing this for many, many years, and there are things that businesses can do to actually increase value and, as you call, harvest value in that business before the private equity people do it. What are some of those things that business owners should be looking at as ways to increase the value of that business?
Okay, well, there's a lot of things. So thanks, Andy. So firstly, this is we're talking about a scenario where it's 2 years or less to go, but more than a few months, because mere window dressing as the company approaches the transaction date really isn't going to fool anybody. I mean, you've got to have real performance improvement. And for the purpose of this discussion, I'm going to assume that the company is not currently being run the way a private equity firm would run it. And we see this all the time. The owners do well and have done well, and it is a great place to work, but a lot of money is at risk of being left on the table. And I don't want to say there are easy fixes, as everything meaningful takes work, but there are usually many readily available opportunities to unlock value. Now, generally speaking, there's going to be two types of buyers, so-called strategic buyers, who are probably companies in your own industry, but that are a lot bigger, and financial buyers, which typically are going to be private equity firms. And you can't emulate what a strategic buyer would do with the company after they buy it, but you can emulate what a PE firm does. So firstly, I want to say a few words about private equity firms. There are approximately 3,000 private equity firms in the U.S., 3,000. A PE firm is run by general partners who invest funds received primarily from public and private pension funds, endowments, and foundations. And there is a reason there is a private equity industry. Yes, they make some mistakes, but on average they offer a superior return to their investors, or they would not still be in business. Fundamentally, they buy private companies and in the next few years often double the value. Yet the value was already there. The PE firm did not found the company, taking great risks in the early years. They did not create the brand or develop the manufacturing process. They did not acquire and nurture customers or recruit and train employees, all of which was done over one, two, or more generations. However, private equity professionals earn large seven-figure incomes, and many have net worth in the hundreds of millions or more. So how does this happen? It happens because they take the value for themselves that rightfully belongs to the owners of the companies they buy. An example from 3 years ago, my firm was advising a middle market aerospace manufacturer. The CEO was a great guy, and he agreed with our recommendations, but when it came to it, he just didn't want to make the changes. He said, let's leave that to the buyer. It shouldn't matter much. Well, a PE firm bought the company, made the very changes we had all discussed, and then sold it only 2 years later for about double their purchase price. How do PE firms do that? They do it primarily by making straightforward strategic and operating improvements business owners could do for themselves. And there's a long list of things, so just a few. Examples of these improvements include sales, implementing processes that deliver reliable and predictable revenue at a lower cost of customer acquisition, with improvements to the coverage model, mapping to the buyer's process, having a strategic account plan, territory analysis, improved selling tools, having a CRM system, etc. Marketing, getting marketing to support sales and having an optimal brand strategy, and value-based pricing that improves gross margins. Pushing into new markets previously ignored or neglected. Innovation, using the voice of the customer to drive innovation, and analyzing competitors and social, economic, and technology trends to identify opportunities. They're really good at knowing what is profitable and what is not at a granular level, by customer, by product, by channel, and by territory, even by salesperson. There is probably an 80-20 rule where 20% of SKUs, for example, throw off 80% of the profits. So sell more of those and stop selling the losers or change their prices. And if that means less is sold, then good, because profits will go up. Private equity firms have an intense focus on cash flow and balance sheet management, in particular inventory, receivables, and payables, via lean initiatives. They motivate, incentivize, and train management and the workforce to provide superior effort and performance. It's also important to have a long-term growth strategy. Even if the planned sale of a company is near-term, having a growth story with at least one quarter of financial results to demonstrate that it is credible will drive up the multiple that a buyer will pay. Setting financial and non-financial targets and monitoring performance closely via a detailed dashboard. Private equity firms address adverse variances immediately, for a missed month can quickly become a missed quarter, which can torpedo the results for the year. If you are serious about significantly increasing the value of your company in a short period of time, then it will take effort and require changes, but it can be done. Andy, I may be drifting into your territory, but for a final thought, I always ask business owners the following question. Why not increase the value of your company? Then pay yourself a dividend close to the amount of money you would have received from a transaction before the value creation was done, and then you can continue to own the company as well. That's it. Back to you, Andy.
Well, very good. Well, I tell you, that was very well said, and I think that's one of the things that I really enjoy about working with you, Lewis, is you're very specific and very exact, and I always tell people it's a shame when you see businesses that have spent all their life looking for a payday when they can make some changes internally by maybe adding a little debt to their balance sheet and make those investments and increase that value and then harvest that cash. You know, so therefore they're not in such a big need for a transaction. So it's very, very important. So I think these transfer strategies, whether it be gifting, whether it be refinancing your debt, whether it be doing partial ESOP transactions, there's lots of things that you can be doing, you know, over time. Why don't we go to the next slide, Dana? Okay.
Negotiations.
That's right. So I think when we start talking about negotiations is a critical area, part of the process. You know, when we're looking at a transaction and you're at the deal table, now you've gone through and you've whittled down exactly what kind of a transaction you're going to do, whether it's going to be a strategic buyer, whether it's going to be an ESOP, whether it's going to be a private equity firm, whoever the buyer is going to be. Sometimes you're going to get a lower price with better terms, and other times you're going to get a better price with not as good terms. And I think the way in which you structure your sale That's going to be a pretty big taxable event when that occurs. You know, whether it be an asset purchase, whether it be a corporate sale, and so forth. And so maybe, Ron, you can talk about it from a tax perspective. Why negotiating the transaction? What are some of the things that business owners overlook, and what's the big impact to them and their families in dealing with the negotiations of the transaction?
Yeah, thanks a lot, and glad you had me here today to talk to all of you. At Marcum, we really work closely with our clients, but I'm going to back up a step before we get to the negotiations and kind of reiterate a couple things everyone has said. 2 to 3 years before is when the real planning starts, because that's when the taxes come into play and how you're going to maximize your capital gain. Most clients, they all think that their company is worth a lot more, and yet they haven't done the things necessary to get the value out. We recommend to our clients, start doing audited financial statements 2 to 3 years before you're ready to do the negotiations and start and sell the business. Think about cleaning up your books. All the personal, you know, privately held companies, they have a lot of personal things they run through the books. Get it out of the books. Maximize your profitability. Develop your management team internally so there's something that there is to be bought. Then when we get into this, most companies want to sell their stock, because that way they get capital gain treatment and everything. Most buyers, they want to buy assets for several reasons. They want to get a step up in basis for the assets. They don't want the liability of buying somebody's corporation and having the risk of, are there problems with that corporation, whether it be tax audits from previous years, potential litigation from previous years. So there has to be some sort of compromise between the buyer and the seller. And I highly recommend that the client use your advisors closely, use your attorneys, use your brokers, whoever you're going to use to sell the company, and your accountants, and strategize together how to maximize the tax benefit. Capital gains rates are going up. We're now facing capital gain rates of 20% plus a 3% Medicare tax. So that puts you at almost 24% as a capital gain. Ordinary is 39%. That's the ordinary tax rate. So again, a buyer would like to get the ordinary because he can step up the basis in the assets. You as a seller, you want a capital gain treatment. One of the biggest things we have to deal with is the earnout. And I think an earnout is what most corporations get, because you'll get your initial money up front. But on the earnout, you have to be aware that if you tie your earnout to your employment contract, that earnout is going to be taxed at ordinary rates. If you cannot make them contingent on each other, and let's say you had a 2-year employment contract, but you had a 5-year earnout, well, then you're likely to get a capital gain treatment on the earnout because it's not contingent upon you being an employee of the company. So those are things that I find most people don't think about at the time they're negotiating. I'll even give you another thought. If you think far enough ahead of time, many of us who live here in California, we're facing a 13% tax rate when we sell our business. But what if a number of years earlier, you know, 3, 4, 5 years, you could move your business out of California into another state that doesn't have as high an income tax or possibly even no income tax? That could be a substantial tax savings. And we've had clients that have moved their businesses to Nevada because they just tax rate in Nevada as being next to nothing. Really, there's no tax rate in Nevada. So those are some of the tax strategies you have to be aware of. Going public is always an opportunity for cashing out, but it's very difficult, and most privately held companies have a difficult time operating in a public environment. Much more restrictions. You have the SEC looking over everything you do. You have boards, audit committees. Hard to do that. So I think those are some of the things you have to look at, and I say always do your tax planning 2 to 3 years before you think about doing a sale.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much, Ron. That was very, very helpful, and I think that it's really critically important that they do that. Why don't we go to the next slide, and we'll just finish up there with negotiations. Obviously, you want to make sure that you're running your company, and it's most important that there's confidentiality. You know, you want to make sure that if you're going to go to market, you're doing it in such a way that as you are looking at your marketplace where you're going to potentially sell to. You want to be real selective as to who you communicate with. You don't want to have all your information out there for people to see, so you only want to be talking to qualified buyers. So now we've gone through, we've done our transaction, and now let's talk about the post-transaction. We want to take some time off. We want to relax a little bit. You know, you want to make sure that your wealth planning is in place. You want to make sure that everything that you've set up in advance, things are getting done right. You want to make sure, you know, if you've set up a foundation, that maybe you've developed some gift guidelines. Maybe you want to have some retreats with the family and include them in some of your guidelines for philanthropy. Maybe talk to them about your estate planning. Maybe, you know, doing, you know, I find a lot of people spend so much time planning their estates, they actually don't spend much time planning their next generation for the actual inheritance of the wealth that they're going to have. So we encourage families to do a retreat at least once a year at a remote location, you know, maybe a vacation time, and start teaching the grandkids about philanthropy. Start teaching the kids to teach the other family members about investing, so that way one day they don't wake up and all of a sudden they have a big account. You know, that's the number one reason why families in multiple generations in wealth, you know, you think about people like that are kings and queens, or you think about the Rockefellers. Many of these families, you know, if you go back to the 1600s and you think of the Mellons and you think about the Vanderbilts, you know, back in the 1970s, they both had about $100 million, and today one has over $1 billion, and the other one, there wasn't a single millionaire left in the family. And why is that? It had nothing to do with the trusts or the wills or estate planning. It had to do with education. So I think it's really important when you start doing, you know, liability planning and making sure that you have your all these things in place, it's really important. Why don't we go to the next slide, Dana? So when we start looking at post-transaction planning, what I want to do is I want to take a little bit of time and start talking about some of the things that we can start doing to start planning these things. So, for example, one of the things that we can do is we can use our annual exemption. The annual exemption, we're each able to give $13,000 per person, so that's $26,000 for a family member. You can give those out and start gifting those assets out to the family, so that way those assets are not growing inside the family. You want to make sure that you're using out your lifetime exemptions. Currently, it's $10 million for a family member. If you've got a $40 million business, you've got a choice. You can continue to hold all these assets in your taxable estate, in which case, when you pass away, you're going to have estate taxes upwards to 40 or 50%, or you can figure out how much you're going to need to retire. So let's take an example of a $50 million family, and they need $500,000 to live. So maybe $10 million is all they need in their taxable estate, because if you invest $10 million at 5%, that's going to generate $500,000 a year of income. The remaining $40 million, you want to make sure you start gifting that out of the estate, and the first $10 million you can give out either directly, or you can use discounted mechanisms, things called family limited partnerships and things like that, but you want to use up those exemptions. And then obviously it's important that you maximize those gifts, because otherwise you'll be in a position where you're just going to have unneeded taxes that are going to be paid. Why don't we go to the next slide? Okay, so as we go to the next slide, that's where we're starting to talk about family limited partnerships, and that's what I'm talking about. So let's assume I have a business, and that business is worth, again, $10 million, but maybe I only need $5 million of it. So the remaining $5 million I want to transfer out to the kids. I gave a talk at USC on equal and equitable distributions of estates and estate planning, and what I found is sometimes you'll have an active and a non-active child in the business. Well, what's the best way to distribute those assets that are above the amount that you need for retirement? You can set up a partnership, and you can have a general partner, which is mom and dad, and you can have limited partnerships, which are the kids. And what you can do is you can get an appraisal for the value of that limited partnership. So maybe the market value, like Rick was talking about, it's worth $5 million or $50 million, but maybe the lowest defensible value might be, oh, instead of it being, say, you know, $10 million, maybe it's only worth $6 million. Because remember, if someone's having a limited partnership interest, they're going to get a discount for tax purposes on the value of that limited partnership interest for marketability and liquidity, and they can actually transfer something that's worth a dollar for 60 cents. And that's called leveraging a gift. And so that's just an example of how you can lift, how you can gift. Instead of giving $10 million in cash, you can maybe give $6 million in partnership interest, and now you've just transferred, you know, $14 million instead of just $10 million. So that's just an example. Why don't we go to the next slide? So if we start looking at, you know, these types of techniques, other types of techniques would be a thing called a GRAT, a Grantor Retained Annuity Trust. That's another example where you put assets into this trust. Again, instead of putting it into a family limited partnership, maybe you take an interest or shares in the company, you put it into a trust. This trust freezes the future growth of that money or the future growth of that stock outside the estate, and during that period of time, there's payments that are made to the person who made the payment into the GRAT, and then the remaining asset transfers to the beneficiaries, so you're able to keep most of that growth outside the estate. You see, the whole idea here, when you're starting to talk about financial planning, is you want to be in a position where you're gifting these assets out that are above the amount that you need for retirement. Well, if you don't figure out how much you need for retirement in advance of all this, you don't know how much you're going to need to sell the business for. And by the way, when I wrote my book, The Next Step, one of the biggest points I make in the book is the fact that most privately held businesses, they never make it to the third generation. In fact, 80% fail by the second generation. And most of the time, it has very little to do with the actual value of the business, but it's because the parents and the kids never talk to each other about how much money they need from each other. In other words, if I've got a son who's working in the business and that son is making $150,000 a year and that business has no debt, and then you've got the parents who are living on the business making $150,000 a year, now you end up having everything fine. But when mom and dad want to retire, now the business has to put on debt in order to buy out mom and dad. Now the business can't pay that same salary. So it's really important to identify these issues in advance and figure out how big does this business need to be, how much money do I need in retirement, and then make sure you have a conversation and compare the two. And most of the time where the failure comes down is a lack of communication, it's lack of being able to be honest with each other of what the needs are. And sometimes people kind of will continue to run that business until it gets to a point where mom and dad want to retire, and then the son or the daughter that are running this business, you know, they never really spoke about this, and then they say, well, let's just sell the business. Well, it's terrible when I see these things happening. So the whole idea is you can look at it from one perspective of having more money than what you need in the estate, or you might just be in a position where the business has to grow and increase in value. Why don't we go to the next slide? So, you know, as we kind of come to completion here and we start looking at these things that are important and we start looking at all the different techniques, whether it be employee stock ownership plans, whether it be, you know, GRATs or IDGETs, or, you know, all these different types of plans or family limited partnerships, financial planning, all these different topics, as you can see, there is no one-trick pony. Many times you'll meet advisors that'll say you need all this life insurance to cover the estate taxes, or you'll have a person that say you need to set up this charitable gadget to save taxes. The reality is no one has the answer. I've been doing this for over 20 years, and I can tell you I've never met a single person that has all the answers. What you need to do, and you can go to the next slide, what you need to do is you've got to make sure you've got a great team that's in place and make sure you have all those members on that team that allow you to get a group discussion and be able to give you a group opinion. Because at the end of the day, you might find by getting a group together that that group will come to you with some recommendations that are in your family's best interest. And remember, by taking no action, you're actually taking action, because they say the definition of insanity is doing the same thing and expecting a different result. Well, I know there's a lot of people out there that do just that, that are not insane. I know there's a lot of people out there that want to do nothing but grow their business for their families and for their family future. And I just implore you, and I encourage you very strongly from someone who's seen this now for three generations and hundreds of families all over the United States, if you take these steps and you take our guidance and wisdom, you will thank us, because you'll be looking back 3 years, 4 years down the road after you do your transaction. You'll say, you know what? I did it right. I spent my entire career building this business, and I was able to achieve my family goals, both with harmony for my family, with my financial freedom, and knowing that I did the right thing for my employees and for all stakeholders that are involved. And with that, I hope that was helpful to you guys, and I appreciate everyone's time today on our panel. Dana, I'll be happy to take some questions, and maybe our guys can answer more if there are any.
Okay, great. What we're going to do is, in just a minute, we're going to conclude this program on the recording, because we've been asked in the past from our audience to turn the recording equipment off when we have the Q&A time. So I'm going to open up the line in just about 60 seconds so you can talk directly with our panelists. And by the way, you guys That was an amazing, that was the best program I've ever heard on this particular topic.
Thank
amazing.
You.
You'll see on your screen an area to register for our upcoming October 22nd Open Line program, which is entitled House Trust Eats Your Profits. Please sign up today and reserve your space for yourself and let us know if you'd like your staff or other colleagues to attend. In the next few days, you'll receive a recording and PowerPoint for today's program. Please feel free to share it with others in your organization or within your association. Our panelists and I want to thank you for your time today and for all the valuable ideas that have been shared. If you'd like to contact our guests to have further discussion on specifics about your industry, your team, or to have some one-to-one time together, or to discuss any of the ideas shared, you'll see our guests' contact information on your screen, phone number and email addresses. The information shared today is a property of Lighthouse Consulting Services, LLC, located in Santa Monica, California. Our mission statement is to bring effective insight to your organization. If you'd like more information on our services, please write me at dana@lighthouseconsulting.com. If you have other topics you'd like us to address, please let us know. Thank you again for joining us, and we look forward to having you join us for our next Keeping on Track Open Line program. Have a great day. Hold the line. Let me turn the recording off, and we'll open up the line. Just one sec.